So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Professor Jan van den Ende. Excuse me, I think my pronunciation is right. Who is Professor of Management of Technology and Innovation at Rotterdam School of Management, which is part of Erasmus University. Good day to you, Professor Jan. How are you?
Hello, good afternoon.
And should I call you Jan or just Professor? Or
just
Professor
Jan? Of course, yeah.
So, Jan, so for the benefit of our listeners and readers, I mean, can you give us a bit of background, you know, tell us a bit about yourself, a bit about the kind of the work you do before we can get stuck into some of the things that we want to talk about today?
Yeah, thank you. I'm a professor of innovation management, technology and innovation management. Innovation management is about the whole process of creating new products, services, new business models as a company. Mm-hmm. It's a process in a company from generating ideas, developing them into concepts, and creating projects and putting the new things in the market. Mm-hmm. And it's a process that companies have lots of difficulty with. We all know the cases of, for instance, Kodak, who invented digital cameras but were not able to benefit from it.
Yes.
And there are many other companies struggling with this particular process. And we are a group of people here in Rotterdam School of Management of about 20 people. We all do research and teaching on this particular process.
Okay. So the thing, one of the things that we wanted to talk about, I mean, and it's sort of in around the area of sort of co-creation, co-development, collaboration, you know, and how people innovate and get customers involved in that sort of process. I mean, and it seems to me that there's a lot of talk that, and a belief that that's a really good thing to do, and it's sort of most people should be doing it. But then, you know, there's also kind of other people that have, you know, people like Steve Jobs have been famously quoted as saying you can't just ask customers what they want and then try to give that to them. By the time you get it built, they'll want something new. And so, So I just wanted to add that in, because I know that you've just published a paper that's added something to the debate, and the paper's been published in the Journal of Product Innovation Management, and the paper's called Benefits of Customer Co-Development of New Products: The Moderating Effects of Utilitarian and Hedonic Radicalness. Now, forgive me, but that's that's some description, but it's an academic paper, I guess. But, you know, can you tell us about the paper, tell us why you wrote it, what you find out, and also kind of make it kind of almost decipher kind of what you're talking about, because that feels quite complex.
Yeah, okay. At the moment, as you say, co-creation is very popular in the business world.
Yeah.
Also, the concept of open innovation, so not doing everything yourself, but working with other companies, with customers, with research institutes, is also popular.
Yeah.
And it's kind of advertised to companies, you should always do this.
Uh-huh.
But also critics, like you mentioned Steve Jobs, who says we have to show customers what they want, we shouldn't ask them.
Yes.
But also other critics, also in academia, who say, yeah, but customers don't know what they want, the customers don't know what is possible.
Mm-hmm.
So customer information is not that valuable.
Yes.
So there's this debate between the two positions, and we decided with three researchers, one from Australia, one from Reykjavik, and myself.
Yes.
To do a real study on when does it really contribute to your performance as an innovator when you involve customers.
Right.
And in this research, we looked at what type of innovation do you develop. On the one hand, is it a small innovation, incremental, or is it more radical?
Right.
And on the other hand, is it more what we call utilitarian? That means an innovation in an aspect of a product that is has to deal with the functionality of a product?
Yes.
Or is it what we call hedonic? And hedonic means, is it something in the aesthetics of a product, in the emotions that a product provokes, or in the identity that a product gives you?
Right.
To give a few examples, utilitarian innovation is, for instance, in the Netherlands at the moment, electric bicycles are very popular.
Uh-huh.
It's clearly a utilitarian innovation because you go a bit faster, it's easier to cycle. We have a lot of wind here, so it's easier when you have the wind against you.
Uh-huh.
So that's an innovation that is in the category utilitarian.
Yes.
On the other hand, there are products that have more to do with your identity or are a combination of utilitarian and hedonic.
Okay.
A marketing manager of BMW once told me there are three reasons for people to buy a car. One is, does it look cool?
Mm-hmm.
Second, is it safe?
Mm-hmm.
And the third is, do I look cool in this car?
Yes.
So that's of course a nice summary. And in fact, two of these elements are hedonic. So does the car look cool and do I look cool in the car? Those are the hedonic elements of this particular product. So if you are developing a hedonic innovation that's mainly focused on these hedonic aspects, does it also work to involve customers? That was our study.
Right.
And what we found was that customers do contribute to the performance of your project and your product if it's a utilitarian innovation, and particularly if it's a more radical utilitarian innovation. Apparently, customers are able to understand such an innovation, know what it's doing, and they can give good feedback to you.
Right.
The requirement is that you involve customers at different points in time. So not just a single point and asking them a question, but also giving them a prototype, etc. So ask them continued feedback.
Right.
What we also found is that for these hedonic innovations, it had actually an even negative effect to involve customers. So apparently customers are not very well able to give good feedback on hedonic innovation in aesthetics, identity, etc.
Right.
And our explanation is that it has to do with the social process around these hedonic innovations. So innovations in aesthetics and in kind of identity products, people first look at other people, their peers, we call them.
Yes.
How, whether they adopt this innovation, and if they do, they follow.
So like if it's something that's kind of hedonic, it's a lot of their view will be conditional on kind of how others view it as well. Whether if it's utilitarian,
exactly,
and therefore kind of quite functional, then you just know if something's going to work for you or not. It's quite a binary thing.
Yeah. We visited a shoe manufacturer in the Netherlands,
uh-huh,
called Van Dommel, and this person, they developed quite fashionable shoes,
uh-huh,
and this designer of shoes, who was also one of the owners of the company, he said, "I never ask customers what they want. I always just I observe trends around me and in museums and in on television and movies, etc. I look at the world,
uh-huh,
and then I come up with ideas myself for new products, and then I try them out. And that's exactly what the approach should be." And he had a nice example there: green shoes, very bright green shoes.
Right.
That's something no customer came up with, but he developed it, and he's just trying it out on the market to see whether it sells.
Right.
And that's because, as I said, people can't answer the question, would I buy these green shoes? Because they would first look at other people. Is there anybody in my environment, amongst my friends, who will buy them, or a famous actor or so? And then they make up their mind. So it doesn't help very much to ask customers or to show customers prototypes of these type of products.
Right.
That's what we found, and that's the explanation of this result.
And so what about projects that combine the two elements?
Yeah, what we would derive from our results and the advice that we would give to companies is, in that case, take for the utilitarian part of your product, involve the customer, like a car manufacturer can ask customers what new features would you want, what are the things we should improve, etc., and
yeah,
then show them some prototypes of the utilitarian part of the new product. But for these hedonic parts, so these design aesthetics, and particularly if it's radically new,
uh-huh,
you just come up with a proposal, you could say, to customers, and then try it out and see how they react. So that's our advice. And maybe you have to try to stimulate this social process, and that's what some companies also do.
Right.
By having some celebrities adopt your product. Of course, that can help to create this social process, but not necessarily it will work. So you will have to find out, does this, you could say, stick with customers?
Right. And so do you see other companies that are splitting out kind of how they get customers involved in their innovation kind of process that follow along these sort of lines?
To be honest, not really. What companies tend to do is choose one of the two approaches and apply it for their whole product. So I think there's a lot to improve there.
Right.
And the famous example of Steve Jobs, his product, like an iPhone, is of course also a combination of a utilitarian. It has a lot of functionality.
Yes.
And hedonic, an iPhone, particularly in the beginning, but still today, it gives you a certain identity. You have an iPhone and not another brand.
Sure.
But the approach that he follows is the one that we advise for hedonic products, and which is, by the way, it's called design-driven innovation. There are Italian academics who have labeled this approach. It's very common in Italy in this world of aesthetics.
Yeah.
Who have labeled this approach as design driven. And in fact, you can say Apple and Steve Jobs have applied this design driven approach for their whole product.
Yes.
Whereas they could have split it up, ask customers about the functionality and do the design themselves, but they've never done so.
Okay.
I think there's a good reason for that in his case, because Apple also applied this marketing approach of secrecy. So they kept the new product secret to create a hype around it.
Right.
Of course, in that, if you have that approach, you can hardly involve customers before developing in the development process, because you would have to open up to the outside world. It would be very difficult to keep your product secret if you involve a number of customers in the process. So that's, in his case, a reason to follow just one approach for both different aspects of the product.
Yes.
But in other cases, companies can split up these two different aspects.
So, I mean, that's kind of that. You know, that's kind of fascinating. So, what, you know, if I was to ask you to you know, from your findings, and if you were to provide some sort of recommendations or some advice to people that are in kind of firms, in organizations that are involved in innovation or new products or engaging with customers and things, I mean, and how they should apply your findings, I mean, what would be your top bits of advice that you would give to them and say, based on our findings, we recommend you would do this, this, and this?
In general, I think companies should organize this innovation process in a proper manner. So that means that you have in your company, you have thought about, how do I collect ideas? How do I make a selection of projects? How do I implement these different projects? So overall, you should organize this whole process.
Yes.
And you should also make a distinction between the more incremental innovations and the more radical innovations, because the incremental innovations can follow a different and more organized process, you could say, whereas for more radical innovations you need a more flexible process. You should be able to change course somewhere during the process. And
sure.
Then in each of these different processes, you could say, you should create these points of working with customers. So in the incremental products, projects, that can be easy, you just doing a survey with customers or having a focus group, etc. But in these radical projects, the recommendations of us apply. You should split up these different aspects and then work with customers more intensely for these utilitarian parts. And you might involve specialized designers
right.
for the other parts of the product. So organizing this whole process in your company is key, I think, to successful innovation.
Perfect. I mean, that's great advice, and it's great advice in terms of actually splitting it out into different types of innovation as well, and then how you might kind of handle it and how you might get customers involved. But that's great. I mean, is there anything else that come from your research that you'd like to kind of add or make people aware of that we haven't talked about before I ask you my last couple of questions?
Yeah, one trend at the moment in companies is to work also with companies, with other companies, but particularly at the moment, many companies try to work more with startups. So
yes.
That's something new in the industry that you see, and I think that it's an interesting phenomenon and an interesting direction for companies to go. To work with startups to kind of bring in new ideas, because particularly larger companies are often limited in the scope of their activities, in the scope of their ideas. So
yes.
I think that's something interesting to explore for companies. Can we also do so? Some companies even create a kind of incubator within the company for young entrepreneurs.
Yes.
And they work with them, they invest in their activities, etc. So that's something interesting going on these days.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I mean, that's I've spoken to some people that are doing exactly that. There's a company called, I don't know if you're familiar with them, called Amdocs. They're in the sort of telecoms technology space, and they provide a lot of services to big telecoms companies. What they're doing is they're also kind of starting to operate as innovation sort of service providers, where they, because they know the technology ecosystem, they're assembling lots of different startups and then focusing them on some of their big clients' kind of problems. But they're working in collaboration with their clients to facilitate that. So it's, yeah, but I don't see a lot of it, but there's certainly more and more of it happening.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so... Yeah. So for my last couple of questions, I mean, I've been doing something. This is something that's slightly kind of selfish, really. But I've been doing almost my an ongoing piece of research, because I published a book with Pearson last year called How to Wow. It was all about service and experience. And what I've been doing is I've been gauging from different people's perspectives in terms of kind of what Wow service or a Wow experience is for them. So it would be interesting to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, of course, it's every product should have a certain wow, so
yeah.
It should have an added value. But often when we think about wow products, we think about products that very kind of targets high-end customers. So
yes.
Some products very sophisticated, very fancy. But I think there's also interesting directions completely opposite, and I'm a fan of the disruptive innovation theory of Christensen. So for me also, a wow product, but more from a business perspective, are products that are relatively simple and address a very large market. And one of my favorite examples is the budget airlines.
Right.
Probably not a wow product in the sense that you may be addressing, but because it's not a real pleasure to fly in these airlines, but it's a wow product in terms of a business impact, because that's of course huge. These budget airlines, by flying point to point, having different business models with the airports, they are able to address a very large market, and even for the customer, they have some advantages because they fly from small airports, so it's faster to go into the airplane, and the whole process is much faster often, so it has some advantages also for the customer.
Sure.
So I think these kind of disruptive innovations are often the ones most forgotten in industry.
Yes.
That's for me also a kind of wow.
Perfect. Well, that's great. And it's a very different perspective, and so thank you for that. So, and so then just to finish, right, I have this one question I always ask everybody that I speak to on the podcast, and the question is this: is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Okay, thanks for asking. We certainly have. My group of researchers and the people from my group, we are also innovating ourselves.
Okay.
And we have created a MOOC, a massive open online course on Coursera.
Yes.
Innovation management. And you can take it for free.
Uh-huh.
It has seven kind of chapters, you could say. And the course explains the kind of basics of innovation management. So it explains this process that I just mentioned, from idea to putting it in the market, portfolio management, and all the different aspects of innovation management. And in the end, you also can take an exam. Then you have to pay a small fee, but it's not much.
Uh-huh.
So I would advise everybody to take this course from us.
Fantastic. That's splendid. Yeah, and I'll make sure I get that all kind of linked up and things when we publish the podcast. But if anybody wanted to search on Coursera, would they just search by your name, or would they search by, what would the name of the course be?
The name of the course is Innovation Management. So if you type that name and you select it, I think there's only one course with that name, but in case there might pop up more courses, you choose the one from Rotterdam School of Management and then you will have it.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for, one, the work that you're doing and the insights that you're kind of developing, and for sharing that with us today. I mean, that's been splendid. Thank you.
And thank you, Adrian, for interviewing me.